This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Turpin Lamb Theater in the Carl Murphy Fine Arts Center at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Now, those of you in the audience who are the first in your family to attend college, just shout out, hey. Yeah. Well, that's going to be important. Our subject today, late last year, the Pew Charitable Trust published the results of surveys that test the vitality of the American dream, and a big part of that is economic mobility. While two-thirds of Americans who were children in 1968, people now in their 30s and 40s, earn more money than their parents did at the same age, researchers were shocked to learn that 45% of African Americans born into middle-class families during the 1960s now do worse than their parents. And in turn, today we're among hundreds of African-American students who hope to surpass their parents and in turn see their children do even better. Yet the Pew study suggests that even when African-Americans reach the middle class, their grip on economic and social status is fragile. We invite black students and parents to join us today. If you're a student, do you expect to do better than your parents? And parents, do you think your children will do better than you? Our number, as usual, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we're going to be taking questions, of course, from people in the audience here at Morgan State. Later on in the program, we're going to listen to the acclaimed Morgan State Choir and talk with conductor Eric Conway. But first, let me introduce John Morton, the Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Pew Charitable Trust, who's with us here on the stage. And thanks for joining us today in Baltimore.
Thank you, Neil.
And I understand that that one result, that 45% of blacks fell out of the middle class, that was so surprising that the researchers had to go back and check it a couple of times?
That's right. I mean, this is a pretty provocative and astonishing finding. And let's just reflect for a moment on what we're talking about here in terms of economic mobility. What we decided was in the lead up to this election cycle, where there was going to be a very robust economic debate around lots of issues that you've no doubt been reading about, including income inequality and issues that were quite important but yet very divisive. Could we put a project together and do some research around this question of economic mobility, which to our belief really forms the fabric of the American dream? This question of can you do better than the generation that came before you, and is where you're born, does that dictate where you end up? And I think both of those questions are core questions to the American dream. First, you want to have a better standard of living than the generation that came before. And second, that the parents to whom you are born, the income of the parents to whom you are born, should not dictate where you end up. And in fact, as Neil just suggested, by and large, two-thirds of American families, and these are families that we followed over a 40-year period, in fact have higher family incomes 40 years later. So children that were born in the late 60s end up being part of families that have higher family incomes 40 years later, two-thirds of those families. But a full nearly half, or 45%, of children born to middle-income African-American families have fallen down to the bottom quintile, the bottom 20% of family incomes over that same period. So big picture, a fairly good picture. For certain portions of the population, in particular this middle-income African-American portion, an altogether different story and a very, very disappointing one.
And it's been said that one of the reasons Americans tolerate such wide disparities in income is the idea that, well, even if I was born poor, I can reach the top. There's mobility. And in fact, your study suggested that of those born in the bottom 20%, a very small fraction ever made it to the top.
I think that's a very important point that Neil just said. I want everyone out who's listening to focus on that. The proposition in the U.S. has been for generations that we have high levels of income inequality here. We have traditionally, compared to other European countries in particular, other developed countries. But the trade-off has been that everyone's got an equal shot at the top. And so we are content to live in a society where we accept certain levels of inequality so long as each person has a chance to make it. And I think that these findings suggest that there are portions, not just African Americans, but other portions of society who have a very, very hard time making it up the ladder. And I think the question we as the Pew Project hope to provoke here is why is that? Why is that? What are the underlying causes that keep people in the same position? And just one more data point, 42%, this is not African Americans, this is everybody, 42% of children born to that bottom 20% of family earners are still in that bottom 20% as adults. So we have a very, if you will, sticky bottom of the distribution, where people born in the bottom remain there for a generation or longer.
Well, let's ask why. Ellis Coase also joins us here at Morgan State. He's a contributing editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine and author of The Rage of a Privileged Class. And again, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
So why? Why is this?
Well, I think, first of all, I just want to make a point, which is that anyone who's followed issues of poverty and race for the last 40 or 50 years knows that it's not that easy to move from being poor to being rich in this country. There is the dream, there's the illusion, there's the thought, but it really is not that easy. I think people know that. But let's talk about these figures for a second, because I find them fascinating, as you say, provocative. But on reflection, really not all that shocking, and I'll tell you why. The American family is fundamentally different now than it was in the 1960s. The American family, as you recall, 1965, there was the Moynihan Report, mm-hmm. which talked about what he called, well, he got himself tangled up in words. He talked about a tangled pathology, and he got a whole lot of negative attention. But his essential point was that at that point, one-fourth of black American families were headed by women, that one-fourth of births of black children were to women who were not married. You go forward to where we are now, that looks like a small figure. Now we're talking about over two-thirds. So what that says is that the family has fundamentally changed. If you're looking at a family back then, you're most likely looking at a family with two people and maybe two incomes. Look at a middle-class family now, you're looking at one most likely with one income. Something else that's also, I think, worth mentioning. I was struck by a phrase in the study about solidly middle class, and I would take issue with that phrase, because I don't think making in the mid-50s by current income standards makes you solidly middle class. It makes you capable of surviving, but it does not make you solidly middle class, and particularly when you put that into the context.
Depends where you live in the country, but I see your point.
Well, particularly when you put it in the context of a lot of research which has shown that even black people who make the same kind of income as white people don't have the same kind of reserves or wealth. By one study, they have 8% on average of the wealth of a similarly situated white family. So I think you're talking about people who were tenuously in the middle class, who were a very fragile middle class to begin with. I mean, there's a book that came out a few years ago by Sharon Collins called The Making and the Breaking of the Black Middle Class. And part of her point was that this thing we're calling a middle class, for most people, it's the first generation that's in that class, and they have not a very large grasp, very tight grasp on jobs. And many of these people, not the ones she looked at, but many of the people in the middle class are there because you have two essentially working class kind of poor people making a middle class income.
Let's get some input from here in the audience at Morgan State University. The microphone to my left.
Hi, my name is Kimberly Armstrong, and I grew up in a quote-unquote middle-class family. I grew up right across the street from Morgan State University, and I like to consider myself a middle-class, dwindling down probably into the poor class. My fear is that I have a 23-year-old son who I don't really know will be in a middle class, because rent now is $1,200 a month. He's been having to move back and forth, you know, in with me because of his income, and by the economy, everything being so expensive now, I mean, I can't afford, the average home is $200,000 or $300,000. I can't even afford a $200,000 or $300,000. So, you know, I think our kids today have a lot more challenges when we look at income, when you talk about the gas and electric bill, you talk about food. At the same time, you have the cost of living going up, but you don't have people's incomes going up. I see more and more families where people have to start moving in with each other just to maintain and survive. And I'm talking about on an adult level. Mm-hmm. So when you start talking about our children and youth, especially coming out of college, who can't even get a halfway decent job to just survive. So it's kind of like, I don't know if you ever watch Good Times, but when you watch Good Times, I think I'm still living in those times, and I was just born in 1968, you know, so I'm kind of like leery, and I'm just, you know, in a class, and I really don't know what class I'm in, and I think a lot of people are falling into that trap where they really don't even know what class they're going to be in, because, you know, and you know, we just got finished talking about Obama,
right.
And I say, all right,
Miss, before you go, Kimberly Armstrong?
Yes.
First, you can accept your applause. And also, let me ask, your son, did he get the chance to go to college?
No. Actually, I am really the first person who ever even probably thought about going to college and made it somewhat. But my son, he's just a, I guess you could say, average working. He's married. He has his own family. But it's times when he has to call me and continue to ask me to help him because, you know, things are so expensive and he's not really making the kind of income that he really would like to make.
And thank you very much, and we appreciate it. And John Morton, that raises a lot of questions about, you know, what exactly is middle class. What are we talking about here?
Absolutely. I think there's two points in response to both what Ella said and then what Kimberly said. The question of middle class is a very, very difficult one to put your hands around. We actually talk about middle income here, and so we specifically try to avoid the question of class because class is really, you know, it's in the eyes of the beholder. I think there are people who make $200,000 a year consider themselves middle class, and there are folks who make $40,000 a year consider themselves middle class. We don't make a statement about that. What we're talking about here is again, for the purposes of the statistics, 45% of African-American kids born to middle income, which means the folks in the middle of the income distribution across the economy as a whole. The other point I'll pick up on that Ellis mentioned in terms of family structure, this is a very important point. Very important point. There's been significant changes to family structures, not just in the black community, in the white community over the last 40 years as well. You've had two competing dynamics. One is you've had women entering the workforce at record levels, going from about 30% to about 60% participation in the labor force, which has, in fact, increased the number of dual-income families. But at the same time, you have fewer families that are actually two incomes with children. So these two factors have been working against each other. As a result, we see family incomes over the last 30 years, again, for blacks and whites, going up, but only by about 10% over a 40-year period.
We're talking about economic mobility this hour, more of a struggle for African Americans to climb the economic ladder, and then more of a struggle to stay there and see their children surpass them. When we come back, more of your stories, and we'll talk about what middle class really means. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan on the campus of Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. We're talking about economic mobility this hour, particularly for African Americans in the struggle to enter the middle class and stay there. We're talking today in Theater Morgan with John Morton, Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Pew Charitable Trust, and with Alex Coase, contributing editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine. We want to hear from listeners across the country as well as from our audience here at Theater Morgan. What's your family's story as they climb the economic ladder and which direction? Will you do better than your parents? Will your children do better than you? Please give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also check out what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's go to the phones, and Peter's with us. Peter calling from Cleveland.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Peter. Go ahead, please.
I'm a white physician, and my parents helped put me through college a little bit. They didn't have a lot of money, but they did help me put me through college a little bit, and I got help from my parents in going to medical school. And I heard a figure, if somebody there could verify it, I would appreciate it, but it's only part of the question, so I'm going to go on. The figure is that the average wealth of a middle-class black family is about 10% of the average wealth of a white middle-income family.
John Morton, does he have that statistic
they
right?
They have savings and retirement and things like that to lean on.
Ellis Coase, I'm sorry.
According to Black Wealth, White Wealth, which was the publication that came out about 4 or 5 years ago, the average black family has 8% of the wealth of the average white family.
I would like to comment on that and say that it strikes me that you, in order for a family to get economic takeoff like a nation, it has to have a certain amount of accumulated capital. And it seems to me that black people haven't had a chance to really develop that kind of capital. And it's one reason why we should consider reparations down the road, that white people should consider reparations as a justifiable thing, because I don't see how black families can continue to have generation after generation go without the families being able to provide help to the kids, especially as the standard of living gets higher and higher and the price of college gets higher and higher and out of sight.
Well, reparations is another topic for another show, but
it's another topic. But
that's
but
actually there's been some polling data on that, and last poll that I recall looking at had 96% of white people against reparations for African Americans for slavery. So, so that's give you some indication of what the support is for that.
The political, but John Morton, getting back to Peter's point about wealth and accumulated capital and how that can help project a family economically.
Right. I mean, there's no doubt that, and the figures that Ellis cites, I have here in front of me as well, about 8 to 10% of the wealth at similar income levels. So these are a white person, a black person making the same amount of money. What's in their accumulated wealth accounts, whether it's housing or bank accounts, et cetera, there's almost a 10-to-1 difference. And lots of, I think, historical reasons why that might be, lots of perhaps cultural reasons with respect to participation in 401k plans. There's a lot of good literature about differential rates of participation in employer-sponsored 401k plans. But I think the underlying message here is that from a public policy perspective, if you think that accumulated wealth, as the caller certainly did, is important to ensuring that you are able to transfer some economic status onto your children, then public policies that promote wealth accumulation for folks who don't have it would be an important part of the public policy discussion. And again, that's a piece of the public policy debate that's just beginning to kick off now.
And clearly it's important to me, because if you have wealth, it makes it easier to support your child's education. It makes it easier to help with a mortgage. It makes it easier to help with a bridge loan when someone's having a hard time.
Cover their health care.
So clearly that's an important part of mobility. But I think something else has radically changed as well since the 1960s. And the questioner earlier said she had a son, and I think it's particularly when you talk about young black men these days. What has happened is prison. What has happened is incarceration. You go back to the 60s, you had 1/6 the prison population that you have now. And you go back to the composition of that prison population, it was a little bit over 1/3 black. Now you have over 2 million people in state and federal prisons in any given day. And nearly half of them are black. The majority of them are people of color. That has changed life odds for this entire generation, and certainly for this entire generation of young black people in certain communities, many of which you have communities where most of the people who are young and who are male have had some acquaintance with incarceration. And what that does, obviously, is it makes it a lot harder to be employable. It makes it a lot harder to be viable in the society, and it makes it a lot harder to buy into this American dream. And we referenced 1968 as the starting point. 1968 was in some ways the high level of the civil rights movement. It was when King was assassinated. It was when Kennedy was assassinated. It was when cities were burning. If there is one movement that needs to take place now, in my opinion, it's a movement to deal with this prison situation, because I think in the same way that blatant discrimination was hurting people now, this incarceration of so many people is destroying communities at this point.
Let's go to the microphone to my right.
Hi, yes, my name is Anita Bowen. And I was just wondering, what do you think drives people to do better than their parents, even those with parents who are financially more successful than they are now?
What do you think, Ellis Coase?
Well, I think that there's a psychology called learned optimism, which is sort of a new branch of psychology, which talks about the ability to have faith in the future. And I think that's a lot of it. It's a lot of it, and some of it seems to be what people just come with. Some of it is rooted in all kinds of things that contribute to faith. I mean, I think one of the you were talking about Barack Obama and his vision of America earlier, and why it's exciting people so much. I think why it's exciting people so much, one of the reasons, is that he's talking about a better future. He's talking about hope. That's something that people love to buy into, and something that people really want to buy into. So it's not, to me, strange at all to think that most people really want to do better than their parents, and many of them do. I think what's happened is that it's become harder for a lot of people to believe that when confronted with the reality that they're facing.
John Morton?
If I could just jump in and say that, I mean, the public polling around this question is very, very convincing and very disappointing. In exit polls after the 2006 elections, fewer than 1/3 of people who were polled believed that, or said they believed that the next generation would be as well off as they are. So I think the public mood here in terms of these generational improvements is really shifting. And the question is whether that's based upon a short-term, you know, housing crash or longer-term issues.
Let's go to a caller, and this is Calvin. Calvin with us from Boise, Idaho.
Yes, I strongly disagree with many of the comments that I'm hearing. I think the true story of the success of an emerging black middle class is not being told. Most of the children of the parents of my generation are doing extraordinarily well now. Their parents were in education or working for the government, whereas today they're working for some of the major corporations, their leading divisions, or even the major corporations themselves. So that there just continues to be a myth perpetuated by white people and many black people that blacks are not doing better, and I can assure you that they're doing much, much, much better than the people from my generation.
John Morton, you want to address Calvin's point?
Absolutely. It's a very, very good point, and I'm sure Ellis may have something to say on this as well. These data do not suggest that there is not a strong, robust, and even growing middle class. That is a storyline that is entirely consistent with what we find here. What we find, however, is that the families that rose to African American families that rose to middle income status back in the 60s were, for one reason or another, unable to pass along that middle income status. Many of them, 45% of them, were unable to pass along that middle income status to their children. It says nothing about whether or not there is, in fact, a growing middle class today, which I think most folks would agree there is. But it does suggest that there's a large portion of families who got to a certain status back in the 60s, and then for reasons, whether they were family structure reasons, asset accumulation or failure to accumulate assets, or other reasons, were unable to pass that advantage on to their children.
Ellis Coase, it's been noted in commenting on this study that maybe those African Americans who reached the middle class in 1968 were such stars because it was so difficult in those days that maybe it's not such a surprise that their kids cannot surpass them.
Well, I don't think that's the reason. I mean, I think there were certainly a lot of exceptional people back then. There are exceptional people in every generation. I think it would be a disservice to this generation to suggest that there are not as many or more exceptional people who are young now as there were back in 1968, I think. But I do think that it's harder in many ways to move from one class to the other. I mean, the caller can, and we can certainly debate statistics, but if you look at the economic statistics, it seems to be the case is that there was a black middle class that was growing roughly from the 1940s to 1990s, and then some stagnation has set in, and it's not really growing appreciably now, which is not to say there aren't a lot of very successful black people. Obviously there are. Which isn't to say that there are not even black millionaires and a couple of black billionaires. Obviously there are. But I think the two things are happening at the same time. But we're also seeing a country where it used to be, if you didn't have a college education, you had a pretty good shot at making a good living. Now you don't really have a pretty good shot at making a good living. It's going to be much harder. And we're also seeing a country where there is a greater gap between those who have and those who don't have, and that's playing out in every community. In New York, where I live, the last census shows that the top fifth population makes 52 times as much on income as the lower fifth of the population. That's up from 32 times 10 years ago, and up from 20-something times, from 22 times 10 years before that. So the fact of the matter is we are seeing, you know, both the upper quintiles doing much better, and even if you go to the top 1%, top 2%, they're really doing well. Mm. Whereas those people who are not been able to get up into that stratosphere are not doing nearly as well.
Let's read this comment we got from Rudolph, an email from Rudolph in Kansas City. To me, this issue of second-generation blacks not doing as well as their parents is one that we as black Americans have to address ourselves. Young people are doing all sorts of things to prevent them from doing as well, like dropping out of school too early, having babies too young, getting involved in criminal activity, and not following the good advice of their elders. The Bible is clear on this. Proverbs 1:8 says, "Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching." The old school stuff has not changed. Just in that regard, John Morton, I was interested to see among your findings that an increasing percentage of African Americans, nobody believes that racism has vanished, but say it's more of an individual's responsibility than the result of racism.
Right. These were findings that were put out by the Pew Research Center, one of our affiliated organizations that's with Pew, and that was indeed the finding that I think there has been a and Ellis can I'm sure reports on this as well, but more of a turn toward individual responsibility and looking for individual responsibility to be part of the solution. Wasn't part of our studies, but it was certainly received a lot of coverage.
John Morton is Managing Director of Economic Policy at the Pew Charitable Trust, and also with us here on the stage at Morgan State University, Ellis Coase, a contributing editor and columnist for Newsweek magazine, author of Rage of a Privileged Class. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another question from here in the audience.
My name is Thais Meadows, and I'm a junior here at Morgan State University. I am part of the middle class, or my mother was. So what I say is that it is an obligation for the parents to instill in their children the confidence to go out for opportunities, to put them ahead of their parents. It's the parents' obligation to instill in their child that they must do better than their parents have done. And I believe that if I become a parent later on in my life, I will want my children to do better than me. I will want them to have chances and opportunities that I never had. So I want to ask you, do you believe that the parents of the African-American middle class are at a settling point, that when they reach, let's just say, $50,000 a year, that they're like, okay, I've made it. I can support myself to live. So this is where I'm going to stay.
And just before you leave, though, it sounds like your parents inculcated those values in you.
Yes, I live with I'm adopted, but I live with a single mother in Delaware, and she has instilled all the confidence in me to go out for every opportunity of networking. And my only drive right now is just to take care of her as much as she's taking care of me to the fullest of my potential.
Well, thank you for that. Ellis Coase, I wondered if you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly people obviously differ, but I don't get a sense of huge complacency among the black middle class. I don't get a sense among people I know and people I've interviewed and I've talked to of folks saying, yeah, I've made it up to whatever you want to put the number of at, and I'm just going to kick back because now I'm fine. What I get is the sense of concern. With everything rising in price, including college education, people worry that they're going to be able to provide for their children to go to college. People worried about whether they're going to be able to hold onto their job in this sort of fragile economy. So no, I don't think there's complacency. But I also say that I agree with the young woman. I mean, I agree that people have an obligation to make the most of their opportunities, and I think we have an obligation as individuals to seek opportunities. But I also think society has an obligation to provide opportunities, and I think both things are true. And we tend to get caught up in these arguments of, is it personal responsibility? Is it societal responsibility? I think that's a false dichotomy. I mean, it's both. And I know that, and I love Bill Cosby. I know he got a whole lot of attention, you know, for telling young people to clean up their acts and start focusing on education and talking good English
and not take responsibility
buying fancy
for
shoes and taking responsibility for themselves. And that's not a controversial message. Most black people would agree with that. It's what beyond that needs to happen.
Let's get one last comment from here in the audience at Morgan State.
Yes, my name is Issa Coleman. I'm a speech communication major here at Morgan State University. I heard the gentleman, Mr. Morton, said that there's an equal shot to the top. Well, I don't believe that there's an equal shot to the top for the lower class. When you say the lower class, you're talking about the people that live in the ghettos where you suffocate, and there's really no room to improve in the workforce, even in this area here. I'm not from this area, but I've noticed in this area, in this community, the businesses or the workforce is slum, to say. You have McDonald's and maybe a chicken place, but as you go further into the white neighborhoods, there's better restaurants and better job opportunities. And when you speak about the prison population and black millionaires, either which way you want to discuss it, poverty, anything, you have to talk about slavery. We are disadvantaged from the beginning. And in the ghettos and in the slums, there are a lot of police that take advantage of the people who are ignorant to the laws. And then they are put into jail and the prison population. So people don't even get to reach that ladder. So it's never equal for the lower class. Also,
I don't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to give John Morton an opportunity to reply. Sure. We're almost out of time in this segment. And John Morton?
Yeah, Issa, thank you for your comment. I mean, let me be very clear. I did not imply that there was equal opportunity. What I implied was that the American dream is founded on the idea that there should be equality of opportunity, not necessarily equality of results, but equality of opportunity. I'm 100% in agreement with you. What we see today and the figures that we have here suggest that there is not equality of opportunity. We're looking at figures that show about 6% of children born to that bottom quintile, actually the bottom 20%, actually make it to the top within their lifetime. That's, you know, I think people would dispute whether that's equal opportunity. So I think I'm agreeing with you 100%. If I could make one comment, Neil, about education very quickly.
Very, very quickly.
Education is the best way to narrow the gap. And we'll have a report coming out in about a month that shows that.
All right. I think people here at Morgan State University know that. Our thanks to John Morton of the Pew Charitable Trust and Ellis Coast of Newsweek magazine. Stay with us. Coming up, the Morgan State Choir. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.